little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick. I'm here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Bob.
Well, I'm very excited about getting into this conversation on this edition, and we're all ready to go. I've got two teaser clues as to what we're up to on this episode of Thinking Clearly. And the first kind of gives you a general idea and is a quote from Harvard professor and primary founder of the field of sociobiology, E.O. Wilson, who said, and this is one of my favorite quotes, I use this a lot in my conversations, he said, "The real problem of humanity is the following. We have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology." And the second quote, it's going to give you a clue as to what we're up to, comes from a book written by our guest for this episode and reads like this: "The path forward requires systems to mediate, not manufacture consent. We need systems that are resistant to top-down control and corruption, but also to bottom-up breakneck rumors. This requires a heightened awareness from all of us, a recognition of our own biases and preferences, a commitment to balancing skepticism and trust, and a genuine desire to share the same reality." And I really love that last sentence because it invites us all to become empowered by something that sounds a lot like critical thinking.
All right. Well, I love those teasers. And so we'll just dive right in. The topics for this episode include the work done at Stanford Internet Observatory, understanding the three key forces which have developed in current online communications and the resulting shift in the dynamics of power and influence that has occurred, understanding what is meant by the phrase freedom of speech but not freedom of reach, how internet communication differs from previous communication innovations, what we can do to mitigate the downsides of internet communication while incentivizing its power to rekindle trust and cooperation to help us find common ground and shared conceptions of reality.
And with an undergraduate degree in both computer science and political science, our guest, researcher and author Renee D'Aresta, honed her skills at learning details about how information travels on the internet by monitoring misinformation related to vaccines, and then advising the California State Senate as it deliberated California State Senate Bill 277. That's the law that removed the personal belief exemption from the vaccine requirement for California school children. She later went on to become the research manager at the Stanford Internet Observatory. That's a multidisciplinary program for the study of abuse in information technologies with a focus on social media. And her work included examining digitally based rumors, analyzing geopolitical campaigns created by foreign powers, voting related rumors that led to the January 6th insurrection, and health misinformation and conspiracy theories during the pandemic. Renee's writing includes articles in The Atlantic, and also Wired, New York Times, Washington Post, Yale Review, The Guardian, Politico, and Slate, as well as many academic journals. And now, Renee is educating us all by sharing her knowledge and experience in a wonderful new book called Invisible Rulers, The People Who Turn Lies into Reality. Renee, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, before we start with the topics, let's clarify that you're no longer with the Stanford Internet Observatory. And both the observatory and you personally became the targets of a social media instigated campaign which seemed aimed at stopping that work being done there to monitor and study digital election-related rumors and conspiracy theories. Listeners can get details by reading your book, but give us just a quick run through on what happened.
Sure. So in 2020, we ran a project called the Election Integrity Partnership. It was four different organizations: Stanford, University of Washington, and then two a digital forensics research lab at the Atlantic Council, and a company called Graphica that studies social networks and how information moves across communities. We set out to try to understand rumors about voting specifically. So not Hunter Biden's laptop, not what candidate A says about candidate B, but just claims that would move around people being concerned about voting machines not reading their ballots, Sharpie markers, invalidating ballots. Rumors that said things like that there was massive fraud, absent any evidence of fraud. Claims that tried to delegitimize the election to say that the outcome was wrong because there had been so much fraud, these sorts of claims. So we studied that stuff for August of 2020 through around December of 2020. And then we wrote a report on it, and it sat on the internet for about 3 years. And then all of a sudden, when the House changed hands in 2022, several congressmen who had voted not to certify the election, like Congressman Jim Jordan, like Congressman Dan Bishop, began to launch quote-unquote investigations, alleging that our work, rather than studying and documenting and trying to respond to these rumors as they emerged, actually had been a vast censorship cabal that set out to steal the election, to disrupt the election, to take the win away from Donald Trump. And this led to a bunch of congressional subpoenas. This led to multiple lawsuits, including from Stephen Miller, the former immigration czar of Donald Trump's White House. This led to a whole lot of different forms of lawfare and harassment and many, many, many misleading propaganda campaigns. And ultimately, Stanford decided that it was not going to continue to do that type of research. And so in June of this year, June of 2024, several of us were not renewed for funding reasons as the university chose to stop studying election rumors and disinformation campaigns. That is why I am no longer at Stanford.
Sounds like a rough ride.
Well, you know, there's historical precedent there, right? We've seen McCarthyism happen in the past. When we look at these things through hindsight, we recognize them for what they are. But unfortunately, that doesn't translate into institutions knowing how to respond appropriately to them as they're happening. And so I think, you know, at a minimum, it'll make for a good second book.
Well, that's a great perspective, I think, and really on point about institutions and how they handle these sorts of things. You know, folks who know me either on the radio or in person know that this is a topic I've always been really interested in and kind of digging into, like, what are the realities about the security of the processes of our democracy, things like that. So I could see the interest, but maybe you could give us some highlights. What led you to get into this work? What kind of sucked you into it, studying online adversarial abuse long before you ever got into the sticky situation with the Internet Observatory? So what led you to this work? What led you to kind of dive into it? And what led you to land at the Stanford Internet Observatory? It sounds like it was good work.
Yeah, so we studied many, many things besides elections. It's sort of funny that that's what we became known for, because we have so many other, or had so many other lines of research. When you have an incredible technological ecosystem where people can use it to obtain power, right, political power, where they can use it to obtain wealth, where they can use it to scam people, to manipulate people, to harass people, it's a whole lot of different actor types and manipulation types that happen on the internet. And so SIO and me, my work, even prior to coming to SIO, looked at those things, looked at how different types of actors use the same tools and affordances that we have all been given, but use them in particularly manipulative ways. So for me, I was interested early on in ways in which small groups of people could make themselves look much bigger. Again, this is sort of using platforms the way they're intended to be used. So I studied anti-vaccine activists in California in 2014, 2015 timeframe, long before the pandemic, just to try to understand why, if polling was showing that 85% of the public in California supported vaccines, the social media conversation was almost 100% negative. It was very hard to find any pro-vaccine voices on the internet at that time. And so I started looking at ways in which some of that was a function of understanding how to use algorithmic affordances better, understanding how to make content trend, understanding how to build networks for amplification. Nobody in public health was doing that. Nobody in public health was treating the internet as a system that they needed to engage on. So some of it was, again, just that understanding of the importance and the power of the system, whereas, you know, the CDC and others were still thinking, like, well, we put out a press conference, you know, and that's what we do. But there was also kind of explicitly manipulative things like running bots, right, to try to make things trend. If you couldn't do it through your real numbers, you could make fake people to make you look bigger, right? So just this interesting dynamic of what the incentives of the system created for activists, taking pages from spammers, actually, from, you know, who were also running bots at the time. It was this very interesting kind of real-time observational effort into how social media was just shifting communication power. And, you know, and what I was interested in is, okay, well, what do we do to respond? You know, but what is the appropriate response? Does everybody go and begin running bots? You know, is that what we all go out and do? So I wound up going from vaccines to actually looking at terrorists who were running bots, looking at ISIS. Again, small numbers of people who were really just achieving disproportionate attention and reach on social media because their content was so sometimes horrifying, right? The beheading videos and things like that, and sometimes compelling, really just incredible propaganda videos designed to recruit young men and young women to come join the cause. After looking at these very sort of overt things, I wound up looking at covert action. So Russia running completely fake people, people who were not real at all, masquerading as American activists, not only on Twitter, but on Facebook and on Instagram, really ingratiating themselves with very, very specific niche communities that they wanted to manipulate, that they wanted to sow division among. So the work that I've done over the years, you know, it runs the gamut from what I call propaganda and influence, to also looking at things like child safety. We're very interested in when new technologies come out, how does that change the playing field? As generative AI emerges, what happens next? I do a lot of work on generative AI spam and scams right now, you know? So adversarial abuse, I think it's a fascinating field. And that's because there's always something new. There is always some big shift that is happening, some technological capacities, some source of motivation, some unintended consequence of a bad incentive. It keeps the research very, very interesting.
Renee, what we're hoping to do in this episode is to use about half the precious time that we have here with you to sketch a picture of your view of the current state of our information ecosystem. And encourage people to get the details by getting your book, which I heartily recommend, because you go into a great deal of context, history that I've never heard in other places or read in other places. So I encourage you to do that. But sketch for our listeners a picture of what's going on with the primary forces that are on the internet and the interactions between those forces. And then to leave a good amount of time to encourage that activist part of ourselves, which is what can be done about this. Sometimes we talk about things on this show, but we get into the foundational work and the context, but there's not enough time then to get into, well, what can people do? And that can be frustrating for people who are really primed to actually do something. So let's start out first, though, with the big picture and with this quote from the introduction to your book. It goes like this. This is not a book about social media. There are enough of those. Rather, my focus is on a profound transformation in the dynamics of power and influence, which have fundamentally shifted, and on how we, the citizens, can come to grips with a force that is altering our politics, our society, and our very relationship to reality. So get into a few of the details on how have the dynamics of power and influence shifted, and how has this shift altered our politics, society, not only those, but also our relation to reality itself.
One of the things that happens whenever there's a big technological shift is there's a sort of, in communications technology, there's sort of a societal reordering. We saw this with the printing press, for example, right? Back in the 1300s, you see this incredible, profound transformation, a loss of power by the Catholic Church, right? And then you see the 30 Years' War happen as a scramble for power reemerges. You see a democratization of access to information. You see the ability to move information from community to community, even if it's through pamphlets moving on horseback. When you see the transformation into the rise of mass media, in radio, you have one person, one speaker able to reach millions of people. When you have the same thing with television, you have the same dynamic and you have the visual component added, right? Just a different style of content becomes the most effective way to get a message out there. The internet does the same thing, but the internet really democratizes the ability to create content, and then social media democratizes the ability to distribute it. All of a sudden, everybody can get their message out there. And what they have to do that is produce content that maybe an algorithm curates, maybe an algorithm amplifies. But they do all of a sudden have the power to be creators with reach commensurate with mass media. And so you see a very, very big shift happen there. Because the other thing that happens is the audience, even if they're not creating content themselves, becomes an active part of that distribution process. It's not only the algorithm doing it, it's people clicking the share button. It's people clicking the like button. People take the post from Instagram and you know, put it up on Truth Social, for example. They take the Facebook video, they repost it to TikTok, you know. So you have people becoming very active participants in this information distribution ecosystem. And they get very, very invested when they do that. And the other thing the internet does is it begins to, social media in particular does, is it begins to connect people around ideas and identity. So reality has always been determined by who we speak with and how we relate to them, right? Not all aspects. I try to differentiate between, you know, what I call tornado reality, the idea that there is a, you know, there are laws of physics, right? Whether you believe it in or not, the tornado will take out your house. But there are aspects of reality where they are determined in part by people forming opinions about facts that they might encounter and coming up with some particular vision of the universe. Media plays a role in that process as well. And so with social media, you see very big shifts in how those networks of human communication form. It's no longer people speaking to people that they know in their community. It's platforms beginning to connect people around even only hints of common interests. This leads to some really bizarre things, actually, right? It leads to the rise of mass conspiracy movements like QAnon, which could not have existed without social media. Because, you know, normally cults were, again, a little bit more geographically constrained or had, you know, more of a human component, human relationship to a guru. Social media begins to do things like say, hey, you're interested in 9/11 truth and you're interested in chemtrails and you're a believer in these various anti-government conspiracies. Let's recommend you all to each other and create groups where then you amongst yourselves can decide what is real and what is not. And so some of what I write about is just the shift by which that happens. Oftentimes, it's also completely opaque to people who are not outside the communities what happens within the communities. Whereas in prior media environments, there was a little bit more of a sort of a shared sense that everybody was seeing the same thing. So that personalization component and that participation component really transform, lead to the rise of these like very, very dedicated activist, I use the word factional communities, who begin to amass power and influence, even as the older institutional models, they don't really adapt as quickly.
Just one quick follow-up question here. Is that you use a phrase in your book repeatedly, bespoke reality. I had to look that up. It sounded like something out of the Canterbury Tales, but go ahead and just quickly define that and contrast that with consensus reality.
Yeah, no, I was trying to think of a phrase to describe it, which is where, you know, I came up with it in conversation with my husband one night, actually. Bespoke like a suit was... what happens when you get to tailor something to your individual preferences, interests, and beliefs at a very, very, very fine-grained level, as opposed to, you know, consensus reality, an old term refers to just the idea that we're going through this process of coming to consensus and people are taking in different sources and talking about them. And eventually there's some sort of formulation of a shared way of seeing the world. We all basically agree. We might not agree what to do about something, but we get to the same place, the same starting point. So bespoke reality refers a personalized or customized version of reality that is created and reinforced by those algorithmic curation systems that we were talking about based on individual preferences, interests, and beliefs. And so they're not necessarily naturally occurring or organic. They're very much shaped by online environments. It was the idea that you could live in these very, very small niche realities that you personally played a role in shaping. They would be potentially unrecognizable as reality to people who are outside of them.
You know, you were talking about kind of key players and those dynamics. Your research and thinking about those key players and dynamics that help us understand the current information ecosystem has led to recognizing three forces, kind of name these three forces: influencers, which I think most of us have heard of in some regard, the algorithms, of course, also we talk about that in all kinds of ways, and crowds. Can you start by describing these, what you mean by these three forces: influencers, yeah, algorithms, and crowds?
So influence is the ability to shape or alter the thoughts, behaviors, or actions of individuals or groups of people, right? And influencer is a term that comes out of marketing. As people begin to realize, as the internet is growing, that there are people, figures, who are members of communities who happen to be maybe just a little bit more charismatic, they're better storytellers, they have a different kind of resonance, they're creative, some of them are attractive, you know. And those people kind of rise from the crowd and they amass a little bit of a larger following. And so they have a relationship, though, to the crowd, right? So the crowd being the sort of communities of people online who are oriented around a particular identity, a particular interest, a particular belief, a particular demographic. And so you have these people, they're able to make content that speaks to their audience. And so they get more attention, more followings. And this becomes a little bit of a flywheel effect. Once you have some, you can continue to accrue more. The crowd sees them as somebody who speaks for them, almost as an avatar for their community. And then the algorithm, this is all happening on social media, which means that it's mediated by a technological, you know, series of technological processes. The influencer actually recognizes that as well, very, very deeply, that they're creating content not only for the humans that are going to consume it, but for the algorithm that's going to promote it. And so the influencer is also often somebody who's just very adept at understanding, you know, when you make your YouTube video, you need a particular thumbnail. When you, you know, when you make a TikTok, these keywords are, you know, seem to be getting heated by the algorithm right now. They're getting pushed out more. When you're on Twitter, you know, what kinds of language, or right now on Threads, there's this sort of funny thing happening where people are creating kind of like provocative engagement bait and the algorithm keeps pushing it out, you know? So you have people who begin to recognize that they can get more attention. And the other thing influencers do is it's a business for them a lot of the time. They're profiting from it, right? So there's a financial motivation as well. Once you have a certain number of followers, brands, for example, will reach out to you with sponsorships. If you're a political influencer, maybe you'll be invited to cover a convention or to speak at a convention. So it becomes this very distinct kind of process and relationship that the influencer, the algorithm, and the crowd relate to each other.
So you're getting into this a little bit about the dynamics. I think we have a clear idea now about what those forces are. But let's get into a little bit more detail about the dynamics, the interactions of those, power dynamics between those. And in that discussion, the metaphor, the main metaphor that you use in your book to bring this to life and use the phrase human murmurations. I love that.
So in a murmuration, it's I think a lot of people have probably seen them, even if they don't know the term. It's when you see a flock of birds, usually at dusk, the massive flock of birds, and they move in these incredible swooping formations. In the U.S., oftentimes it's starlings, or you know, the little kind of grackly spotted looking birds. So in a murmuration, each bird sees, on average, the seven birds nearest it. That is how this process works. And they adjust their behavior in response to what they see those seven other birds do. So the flock does not have some preconceived flight plan that they're all following. It's just that these patterns happen because these birds are responding to the stimuli of what's in their field of view. And again, the bird can't see the entire flock. It doesn't know what's happening around it. It doesn't know how big the flock is. So each individual bird doesn't know the flock's ultimate destination. It can't make any kind of radical change to the whole. But each of these birds' small alterations shifts the course of the whole. So it's kind of an interesting process that's happening there. Twitter, funny enough, you know, before it became X, the icon was a little bird, right? The idea that everybody was kind of talking to each other and chirping. And so I talked about murmurations in the context of signals that humans pass from person to person, from screen to screen, newsfeed to newsfeed, where, you know, you're a member of that flock, so to speak. And when you share something, you're pushing content out to the sort of seven birds that are seeing what you're doing. right? So you don't feel like you have an incredible amount of power or influence, but you are actually shaping the information environment of the people who follow you, right? Or who follow a topic that you speak about or participate in. If you're an influencer, you have much more potential for reach. Many, many more birds, so to speak, are following you or paying attention to you. It's this dynamic of aggregate things happen. Content goes viral. We use the term passively, but what's actually happening there is a whole lot of individual decisions to share something, to like something, to move something along. And those individual decisions in aggregate transform the information environment, and they shape what people see because algorithms pick up on these very, very small signals and then push them out to more people and still more people. So I liked the model of murmurations as a way of helping people see a seemingly insignificant action actually does have the potential, you know, again, when occurring in that rapid sequence to kind of shift the course of the whole.
Yeah, that's great, because flocks of birds are used as a description to explain emergent behavior.
Exactly.
And it's a very graphic example. Everybody has seen flocks of birds in the sky and marveled, you know, how do they do that? Who's giving the orders to lead the flock? And so that's a beautiful example.
This is, you know, often come up when Bob and I talk about social media. How unique is it? How much is it like things that we've seen before? Civilization and our institutions have survived after the printing press was invented. Some barely survived. And after radio and TV came along, we were able to harness the waves. Is there something that makes internet platform technology qualitatively different from these previous inventions in human communication? You touched on this a little bit earlier, and is there a chance that we can just naturally adapt to this technology without taking aggressive steps to mitigate its downsides?
So it's an interesting question, because there were steps to mitigate downsides in other technologies, right? There are certain guardrails. You know, the FCC, for example, has a whole host of different ways of thinking about regulating other information environments in ways that we don't have on the internet. One thing that's very distinctly different about the internet is that it is amplified personal communication a lot of the time, right? So people feel that the sort of speech environment feels much more personal to people because they themselves are putting content out there. Ways in which a more kind of top-down mass media environment was shaped through regulation didn't really happen quite so much on the internet, in part because recognizing that the platforms were carriers for the speech of their users, there's a whole lot of leeway that's given to the platforms in determining how they are going to moderate and curate content. This actually leads to some really interesting kind of legal dynamics in which the platforms have free speech rights, right? The platforms have First Amendment rights to decide what of their users' speech they're going to curate and amplify, even as users feel that platform curation and moderation is a form of censorship of their own speech. So this interesting dichotomy that's happening there, I think, makes people have very, very, very strong feelings about internet regulation and internet moderation in ways that I don't think most people have, you know, stopped and gone and read FCC broadcast guidelines ever. It's kind of interesting to see the way in which we feel that this is like our space, that we own it and we should shape it. And the metaphor is constantly used, the public square, when in reality, these are private businesses, right? You know, they maybe make people feel like they're in a public square, but that's not actually what they are. So this question of how do you regulate privately owned public squares is one that I think we've struggled to figure out, particularly in the United States. You know, will we adapt? Yes, I think we're in a kind of an intermediate, you know, one of these intermediary periods. As you mentioned, with the printing press, there was the 30 Years' War. but, you know, that also did lead eventually, you know, print media did eventually professionalize, right? There were ethics that began to emerge around what is appropriate behavior for journalists. Not all of them followed it, of course. You know, nobody's saying that there weren't tabloids and yellow journalism and misleading things in the media all the time. But there was at least a sense that people in the industry began to recognize the responsibility that came with power and interested to see when that happens in this space. One of the reasons for writing the book was to try to get that point across.
And you've moved us in your answer to that question to sort of the second part of where we want to go in this episode is what specifically can be done. But I want just a quick answer to a question I have, because we've talked a lot about on this show, and your book talks a lot about, many people have talked a lot about the downside, the dark side of the internet and the crowd on the internet. I'll read a little quote from your book. It says, "They may struggle." This is talking about the crowd. "They may struggle to build alternatives rather than just tearing things down, but they nonetheless offer potential to galvanize nonviolent movements for justice and human rights." So just give us a little bit of idea. What have you observed regarding the bright side of this technology?
The old media environment, if you will, that sort of top-down mass media environment involved significant degrees of control up at the top. I want to point out that social media does too. Just I feel like that gets left out a lot, right? So I think all at this point of the social media platforms, or most of them, are majority owned by a billionaire, right? So this idea that they are different in some way, I don't believe is actually accurate. The attempt to maximize free expression of groups and communities is distinctly different. People do have the ability to go and get their point across. You could not have had influencers in other media ecosystems in quite the same way. In a local community, you could have, right? There were always people who were more popular than others. But the idea that you could build an entire brand from your living room, become a person followed by 500,000 people because you're expressing your opinion, you know, from your couch, this is really very, very different in terms of the proliferation of voices that it brought into the conversation, into the public discourse. So I think that is the thing that we want to keep, right? That ability to have diverse perspectives, people who are traditionally underrepresented, even today in mass media, who feel that they don't see themselves on the television, they don't see themselves in the nightly news. Now they can go and see themselves. They can pick an influencer who they feel is like them, and they can follow that person. They can connect with other people who are just like them or feel very strongly about a particular issue. And, you know, you see the rise of advocacy and awareness campaigns. Not everybody likes them, right? Depending on which side of the aisle you're on, you might feel like some particular hashtag is terrible, but you know it exists, right? So different groups are getting that visibility. And that is the bright side of the technology, I think. You know, there are some downsides, right? The same thing that lets you grow an activist movement or raise attention, something like, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, you also, using the same processes, do wind up with things like QAnon, right? And so this dynamic of what is the technology used for, I use the example of like the hammer, right? You can build a house or you can beat someone over the head with it, right? It's a tool or a weapon. And that's one of the challenges, you know, with social media.
So let's talk about what can be done to incentivize using this powerful technology in positive ways, you know, to help us rekindle trust and cooperation, I would hope, and to find common ground and shared conceptions of reality. Let's start by talking about the elephant in the room. What folks like to throw around a lot these days is free speech and the free speech issue, what that even means. Topics here include what the U.S. Constitution says about free speech, where hate speech fits into the picture. You already touched on platforms, FCC Section 230, benefits and drawbacks of platform moderation, and principles of freedom of speech, not freedom of reach. So in that big grab bag of ideas around free speech, what are your thoughts on the issue?
Yeah, well, first, just to be clear, constitutionally, you don't have a right to free speech on a private platform. If we're speaking in terms of laws, that's where we are. Again, in terms of court cases that have recently come down, Supreme Court has in fact reaffirmed that the platforms have free speech rights, and the platforms, in exercising what they curate and amplify, are exercising those rights. Now, that also is a weird thing, right? The idea that that a corporation has speech rights is something that is a very hotly contested point among different communities in the U.S., but that's where the law is at the moment. So there's a tension here. So people who see moderation as censorship, and that's a very particular propaganda campaign that the American right began to run in 2017, alleging that they were being censored. This was oftentimes amplified by groups and communities that were trying to direct people to join right-wing social media ecosystems that claimed not to moderate. Most of those did not thrive, but that was a draw, right? Like a market differentiator. I think we want platforms, however, to appreciate the value of free speech, even as we're not talking about it in the legal sense of the word. Meaning, these are places where people express themselves. That's why they're there. The platforms are profiting from their desire to express themselves. And so you should want to see a maximization of that free expression. The problem is, again, there are certain things, certain types of speech that are legal under the First Amendment, meaning the government cannot come after you for using hate speech, right? The government cannot come after you for misinformation, disinformation, or any of that. And that's great. On private platforms, though, they do have curatorial discretion. They do decide what gets amplified and what gets seen. And because these are businesses that require a large number of users to be there in order to sell access to them to advertisers, the platforms recognize correctly that environments in which hate speech is rampant are bad environments that most people don't want to be in, right? Most people don't say, hey, I'm going to go, you know, find myself hateful people to hang out with in the public park, right? In the real public square. And so the interesting dynamic on social media is that if you're in a place where content is being curated for you and recommended to you, and that content is this kind of, you know, offensive but perfectly legal stuff, you're not actually going to want to be there. People don't want to be in a place where they're encountering this kind of stuff. They don't want to be in a place where they're encountering spam. They don't want to be in a place where they're unexpectedly encountering pornography a lot of the time, right? Or nudes. There's a whole lot of just kind of cultural norms that go into the way that we engage in the real world, even with the First Amendment. And so platforms are trying to create something of an environment that makes people feel comfortable, that makes them want to stay. And that's where you see platforms trying to do things like moderate hate speech or moderate harassment, or in the case of something like mis or disinformation, recognizing that large networks of inauthentic fake accounts are a problem, that content that actively misleads people into believing an election was not free and fair is a problem. And so again, because they have this discretion, they can make those determinations. So how do we reconcile these conflicting equities, if you will, right? Well, the freedom of speech, not freedom of reach, was a phrase that Asa Raskin and I started arguing for back in 2018, and we argued for it. And the justification was that, you know, you were going to have people who wanted to be jerks online, right, or who wanted to express themselves in ways that other people didn't like, who wanted to argue that vaccines caused autism, right? Or, you know, do things that were misleading, misinformation, but we're not beyond the bounds of where a platform should take them down. And so platforms have a lot of different ways to shape the information environment. They're doing it around you all the time. And so what we were advocating for was that they just do it a little bit differently. That instead of actively promoting the accounts that were speaking like this or promoting, you know, certain demonstrably harmful ideas, something that users could go looking for, but they were not proactively amplified. So if you wanted to find an anti-vaccine group on Facebook, you could go and type it in and find it, but there was no reason for the recommendation engine to proactively push it to you. And that was where that idea kind of came from, that you could have this free speech maximizing environment, you could have all of these different ideas on social media represented, but the platform didn't necessarily have to be actively promoting them to everyone at all times. That the platform, in exercising its discretion, could determine that some things were there so that you went looking for them, and some things were there to be promoted. And that was where the framing came from. Interestingly, like Elon Musk picked it up in 2022, and it is now the moderation policy that sort of sits on top of his his content moderation page. So, I mean, again, you know, I imagine that Elon Musk and I have different ideas about how specifically to execute some of these things. But this is, I think, the only possible guideline that both maximizes free expression and recognizes that platforms have a curatorial right themselves.
It's interesting that you mention Asa Raskin, because I'm a big fan of the podcast that he does with Tristan Harris. And I came to realize, and I didn't really realize this until, you know, I looked up a few things and did a little background when we decided to have you as a guest, but you appeared in their movie.
Oh, yeah, I was in The Social Dilemma.
Yeah.
It was like a whole lifetime ago now, but yes.
Yeah, that's so cool. That really started some intense look at what's going on, and they're still doing good work, kind of shifting now towards AI and the risks and benefits of artificial intelligence. Yeah. You know, my mind flits through things, and when you were talking about no one seeks out a place where there's all this verbal abuse and stuff, and I thought I'd call that a verbal fight club.
There's certainly some people who want it,
I'm sure there are some people that are attracted to that, yeah.
Let me make one point on that very, very quickly, because I just want to say the market has provided for those people already. If they want to be surrounded by that, they can go to 4chan, they can go to Gab. There are places where it exists. Not all platforms have to have the same norms. Not all platforms have to make the same determinations. And I think one of the things I talk about in the book a lot is decentralization, the idea that you will have a proliferation of different environments that you're going to be able to join in the next 5 years or so. And that's a great thing. And that's something that we should want.
And that's what this part of the episode is talking about, is rather than waiting for human beings to hopefully adapt to this technology, what actually actively can we do? So my mind, as we're talking about these issues, goes to where and how changes get made. It seems to me that there's several ways and places that come to my mind anyway. For example, the platforms can make changes either on their own, or being incentivized by the government, or being pressured by users, or the government could create legislation to actually mandate changes. And we'll want to talk about all of those. Or many individuals could just discontinue playing the clickbait game, which is what I do. So starting with the platforms, what the platforms can do by themselves, in your last chapter, you list three things, the first being moderation. What are some of the details in that discussion of what the platforms can do?
For platforms, one of the things I was advocating, first, I believe that platforms have the right to moderate. I don't believe that social media works without moderation. Moderation is the differentiation. It is what makes the platforms feel usable. But the question of how do you do it, you can improve that a little bit, right? For starters, I think transparency, and I feel like I beat this drum constantly throughout that last chapter, a lot of times people don't actually understand what they're being moderated for. They don't understand how the rules work. The rules are very complicated and stuck in 10 different places. They feel unevenly applied, and there is no right to appeal in quite the, you know, you can hit the button maybe, but there's not a whole lot of nuanced adjudication happening there. So whenever we're talking about something related to a platform, the number one overarching shift that needs to happen is transparency. The other area with moderation that I think I reference in the book, and that ties into the theme of decentralization too, is that there's a much higher degree of legitimacy enjoyed by moderation that happens through a community. And so Reddit, for example, has this interesting system where there's top-level moderators, meaning there are rules for the platform as a whole, where, you know, you can't post certain things to any subreddit on Reddit. But beyond that, a lot of the subreddits have their own distinct types of norms, and they will aggressively moderate you if you violate the rules of their individual subreddit. I know, even, you know, you even experience it. I remember I was going to Japan, and I posted something into the Japan subreddit, and I didn't read the instructions as carefully as I should have. And my post was deleted within like 30 seconds, you know? With like a, you know, sort of like a terse bot that responded with some sort of like, you didn't do this, and this, try again, you know? And so, you had these sort of like these funny experiences where you're like momentarily irritated because you did all the work typing out the question, and you realize that like, well, it's also kind of your fault, you know? But there's subreddits that are like, you know, we're for posting pictures of cats. If you post pictures of dogs, you're going to get, you know, your post will be deleted and you'll be kicked out, right? And that's fine, actually. That is when you walk into an establishment, right? There are, again, there are certain laws that an establishment establishment can't violate. But then beyond that, the establishment does have some discretion to kick you out if you're not behaving in a way in accordance with the, you know, what the establishment expects. And so this idea that social media, you know, companies and communities have to tolerate all things at all times is wrong. But at the same time, they can increase legitimacy and buy-in by being clear about what the rules are and having this much more granular community-based style of moderation in certain types of, you know, group-based communities.
Another part of that that you described, and it was kind of new to me, the idea of friction.
Friction refers to something injected into a process that a user is going through to make them potentially slow down just a little bit. Friction can either be visible, like a pop-up shows up. One example of this in the context of social media is, you know, many platforms tolerate cursing. They don't, you know, they're not trying to have a G-rated environment. But if you post something like, you know, F you, right, it'll pop up a little button that says, a little box that says, most people don't talk like this. Are you sure you want to send it? And you can click the button and send it through. But that little moment of friction just gives you a chance to maybe cool down and say like, oh, actually, I can express myself differently. Right. So that's an example of a visible friction. The user knows it's happening. Invisible friction is where content is, you know, topically throttled. Sometimes users become aware of it and they feel almost deceived because it's not made transparent to them. Sort of like a secret hand shaping the information environment. They know it's happening, but they can't quite figure out why. I think friction is great, actually, in a lot of ways. I think it can be used to shift norms and shift user behaviors and can be used to put people in a more reflective state of mind and maybe break through some of the reactionary anger that tends to happen in a lot of social media discourse spaces. So the platforms shape the affordances. The affordances shape the kind of content that's produced and the kind of behaviors that people create. So thinking about how do you do that more reflectively or better is a whole area of social science research right now, you know, sort of the intersection of design and sociology. And I think it's fantastic, actually.
That's great. I'm really kind of visualizing like these layers of moderation and regulation, whether it's peer supported or, you know, assigned moderators. And as Bob acknowledged earlier, there's also government regulation, which sometimes is fabulous and sometimes a little, you know, especially when it comes to technology. So starting with, you know, something that's been of interest to me for a couple decades now is the repealing or retooling of Section 230 of the Federal Communications Act, basically, which says that if I forward an email, I'm not necessarily liable for what's in that email, but the platform could be. It would open up basically internet platforms to civil litigation if 230 was repealed. So in that sense, it can sound like a good thing. And of course, government regulation around the internet isn't isolated to 230, but I'm interested, what are your views on the role of government policy in mitigating these negative aspects of our online ecosystem that we've been talking about?
230 is the legal foundation that lets platforms act as intermediaries rather than publishers. So it gives them immunity from liability for user-generated content, right? If you publish something if a newspaper publishes something, it might be subject to like a defamation claim or something along those lines. If it publishes false information about another person, if a user on a social media platform publishes false information about another person, the platform is not liable because the platform is serving as an intermediary, as like a host. And this law was developed in, I think, around 1996. And the whole point of it was to prevent the platforms from being sued out of existence, right? To be able to create this environment where they were able to support and foster this community-created content environment. It gives them the right to moderate, though. They don't have to always moderate, but they can moderate. And so this it gives them an incredible amount of discretion. And what this has meant over the last 5 to 7 years or so has really been the sort of peak of attention to CDA 230. Different politicians feel that platforms should take down more content, right? And so they threaten to repeal CDA 230 protection if platforms don't take things down. Or other politicians want content to be left up, regardless of, again, the platform's own curatorial right to establish the norms of its space. So a politician saying, like, you must leave this hate speech up, even if the platform doesn't really want it there, is an example of going in the other direction. So you've seen this now coming from both sides. I don't think anybody wants the U.S. government involved in the day-to-day adjudication of content moderation decisions, right? And so that's my feeling on it. I feel like most people agree that it is not the business of the government to determine how user speech. The government can't regulate speech off of platforms. We wouldn't want to give them the right to regulate it on platforms. And so the dynamics here then are that there is an extreme amount of dissatisfaction with moderation, again, on both ends of the spectrum, taking more down, leaving more up. One of the things is, you know, you're starting to see certain types of harm come more into the conversation. Harms to children, for example, shouldn't be covered in certain ways. There's a whole lot of different efforts to pick apart or revoke protections in certain kinds of contexts. There's some concern, though, that when you begin to do that, you inadvertently open the door for over-censorship and stifling of free expression, or under-moderation leading to terrible environments. So that's roughly speaking, that's the kind of contours of the debate. First, from a pragmatic perspective, I just don't think that any regulation is actually going to be passed on this front in the United States. I don't think that you're going to see these parties come together, with the exception of perhaps something related to kids. That might be the one area where there is enough mutual agreement around carve-outs relating to obligations to moderate in particular ways where kids are concerned. Even there, that's become a hot button issue. There's concern that it'll be used to target LGBTQ kids, or concern that not enough porn or whatever will be kept out of the field of view of kids, right? So again, you have that same conversation playing out in each of these niche audience spaces. Ultimately, where I've come down, since I don't believe that it's going to happen anytime soon, is this question of, can the government pass laws that, rather than touching content, bring the actual data underlying the debate out into public view? So I've advocated for a long time now for passing transparency like regulations instead. So, for example, the platforms are very sensitive to public concern and public complaints and regulator concern and complaints. We call this ref working, right? Saying, like, this is how we want you to change, right? And they are responsive to that because this is their business. They don't want to be seen as being completely unresponsive. So when you pass transparency regulations that mandate that, for example, researchers have access to certain types of data feeds to see if a harm is happening, when people have visibility into how moderation is actually executed, when you have visibility into algorithmic curation, there's a whole bunch of different fronts where you can use transparency to get more visibility about what is actually happening on platforms out there into public view. Once you have that, then I think there's plausible arguments for harm-based regulation in certain areas if you need it. That is then backed up by actual evidentiary, you know, kind of a basis of evidence that shows that something is then justified. Otherwise, I think, you know, right now there's a lot of argument, a child safety conversation in particular, just tons of back and forth about what the impacts of these things actually are. And they're very hard to study. So I think that the transparency regulation, you know, I'm surprised we didn't get it several years ago. It's the sort of thing that seems like a layup. One of the reasons why it hasn't passed, I think, is that it's not seen as punitive enough, right? It's like, oh, well, we're making them, you know, show us what's happening, but we're not punishing them for it. And so, you know, it's very hard to get people excited about transparency, unfortunately, but I think it's foundational.
Well, we're getting very near the end of our time with you here, but let's talk a little bit about what individual users of these technologies and platforms can do to make things better.
So first, the goal with the book was to make people aware of like how it works and the role that we all play in it. So some of that is understanding like what a share does, how a trending algorithm works, the fact that it might not actually be trending for everybody, it's trending for you, making people think a little bit more about, you know, when we're talking about moderation, we're talking about like bad stuff at the end, dealing with bad stuff at the end. Are there ways to make people more reflective about what they do up further above, you know, so that we don't have, you know, that we're not focused on moderation, that we're focused more on like, how do we create good communities? What are the roles that we all play in shaping norms within our communities? One thing that we see constantly in social science research is that corrections to misinformation and, you know, are best when they come from someone who is part of your community. So how can you use your relationships to say, hey, actually, I don't think that story is true. Look at this instead, as opposed to waiting for a platform moderator to do something about it, right? So ways in which we can speak up and become, you know, constructive participants, ways in which people can be taught to recognize, hey, this is outrage bait and you don't have to take it, actually. You know, I visited the podcast, The Daily Stoic, right? And there's some really interesting stuff in Stoicism, you know, interesting arguments that, you know, the matter before you actually doesn't have the power to disturb you. Like, you decide if you're going to be disturbed, right? How do we make people think in those terms on social media as well, or recognize that, you know, if you saw something that, you know, saw a newspaper headline that made you angry at the supermarket checkout counter, you know, you don't need to scream about it. You can, you know, it just kind of rolls right off. And so you, and then you go about your day. And these are the sorts of things that I think we need to be thinking a little bit more in terms of how our own actions and reactions and our role as members of communities and information propagators today can be done much more mindfully, treated much more mindfully than where we currently are.
Well, thank you very much. And you can choose not to buy that tabloid. And that's the system I advocate for, is that we can make our choices to make these technologies work, to do the kinds of things that we want them to do, that we need them to do, without getting hooked into the clickbait and the manipulation of our emotions. So, Renee DiResta, thank you so much for sharing your research, for your deep thinking and personal experiences relating to the details of negative and abusive influence and power on the internet, and what we can do to mitigate that. Well, harnessing that power of the internet to bring us together to thrive as we reestablish, hopefully, the trust and cooperation that we're going to need to meet those future global challenges. And thanks also for writing that book. I highly recommend it, Invisible Rulers, The People Who Turn Lies into Reality. On your Facebook page, we're going to post your personal website, and that's reneedirista.com, spelled reneedirista.com. And we're going to also put up a link to your Wikipedia page and a link to your book. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post?
No, I think my social media links are all on the website, and I'm an active poster on Threads, Mastodon, and Blue Sky these days.
A heartfelt thank you to our listeners. And as always, Julia, thank you.
Thank you, Bob. And I'll see you on Mastodon, Renee.
Thank you.
And until next time, keep thinking.
Clearly. Think for yourself, people. It's your first and your last chance.